Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah argues that U.S. Magnesium is unable or unwilling to protect the Great Salt Lake as a judge appoints an outsider to run the company. A new road will bring a new era for a multi-billion dollar future at the former prison site at Point of the Mountain. And here are the stars spotted at a Star Wars-themed resort deep in the Utah desert. Those are the headlines we'll be talking about today. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, morning, Tom.
Thank you. Real estate reporter Tony Semerat is with us. Thanks, Tony.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. And reporter Mark Eddington is with us. Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on. We'll start with Megan. So U.S. Magnesium, we've heard, you know, over the last few years, heard a bit about U.S. Magnesium. So the latest is, I guess the company's been put in receivership. What does that mean?
So that means there's a neutral agent who's going to come in and kind of run the company, safeguard their assets, and help keep them like in compliance with what they're supposed to be doing environmentally.
So there was a consent decree with EPA 2021. What were they supposed to be doing?
So they're supposed to be cleaning up some old contamination from when they were mining magnesium, which they haven't been doing for a couple of years, at a new filtration plant to treat the wastewater coming out of the facility. And do some other stuff to mitigate pollution and waste, because they almost directly abut the lake, and that includes needing to put in like some walls in a wastewater pond where they had been dumping chemicals for quite a while.
So these chemicals, some of these are pretty toxic. What kind of chemicals are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the not fun ones. I mean, there's, you know, it's ones that you know, often you would probably struggle to pronounce. They can be carcinogenic and, you know, like lead to cancer. But thankfully, they're not really close to any people other than people who are working at the plant or at nearby facilities who, you know, state officials have said before, like pretty much know the risks and like are already taking measures to avoid that. But there are some potential like ecological concerns for like birds and brine shrimp and other like small organisms that are in the lake really close to the plant.
So understanding from your story, you wrote a couple stories here along with Shannon Sullett. I guess a company like U.S. Magnesium takes salt, breaks it down into its component parts. One of those is chlorine. And I guess, you know, you have chlorine in your swimming pool, but I guess it's high concentrated chlorine that can cause problems.
Yeah. So, I mean, we put chlorine in swimming pools because it helps break down bad things. But if you have too much of it, it also starts breaking down good living things. So you don't want to have high concentrations of it.
So do we know if any of this stuff has made it to the Great Salt Lake?
At least in 2016, they had seen some migration of it toward the lake, but it hadn't made it into like the lake or the lake bed itself. And kind of, you know, the mixed good news with this is because they haven't been producing and they haven't been adding a ton of water to the pond. These chemicals are bad, but they don't really like to move. A state official described them as kind of like sticky. So they'll stay in the soil as long as they aren't being pushed through by more water.
So as you mentioned, U.S. Magnesium has not been producing, or what do you call it, mining magnesium.
Yeah.
I guess you take the salt and you break it down. They haven't been doing that since 2022. So I guess their point is, that they've been saying is, since we're not producing anymore, we don't need to continue building these mitigation factors.
Yeah, that's at least what they told us is, you know, hey, the concern is kind of stopped. We're not adding any waste. But, you know, the state and the EPA said that's not how it works. You still have to comply with this consent decree because, you know, the molecules aren't going to move a whole lot, but there are still definitely some bad things already happening in that area that they need to take care of.
Now, I guess it was the state that sued and got this latest action.
Yeah, so the state has been in charge of most of the compliance things, so monitoring construction, and because the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands is in charge of like overseeing the lake and it, you know, its protection, they sued to ensure that you know this compliance, that this consent decree is followed, and that you know we actually protect the lake from these chemicals.
I guess I should back up and talk about magnesium. I guess it's used, I'm reading it's used in electronic parts, car manufacturing.
Yeah, it has quite a few uses. But what we heard is that there a lot of their equipment has broken down, and they haven't been they just haven't been able to mine. And they're the only source of magnesium and like this pure magnesium, so not like an alloy where it's mixed with other metals in the US. So right now we're trying to have a reporter look into, you know, what does it mean for, you know, the future of magnesium if they aren't able to get back up and running, especially if they aren't able to, you know, get the environmental protections in place. That's kind of a prerequisite to really keeping going.
So companies must be getting magnesium from overseas, I guess, obviously, right, at this point.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of imports of magnesium because that's been going up.
So interestingly, UX Magnesium, at least at one point, was doing lithium mining from its waste piles. That's kind of interesting. And of course, lithium in lithium batteries.
Yes. Yeah. They were doing that for a little bit because one of the chemicals that's put off as you're mining magnesium, and you know you're extracting that from the salts, there's still the lithium left in the salt from the Great Salt Lake. So they had been mining that, but the lithium prices started going down and it just wasn't profitable enough.
So, U.S. Magnesium been subject to, I guess, some suits from some contractors, right? One contractor is supposed to be building this underwater wall to mitigate the release of some of these chemicals.
Yeah, that's kind of that's the one that really flagged this issue for us because you know it's if you know if they aren't being paid, they aren't going to keep building the wall. And you know, US Magnesium just didn't have the money to pay them because they haven't been able to, you know, to mine these minerals. But that doesn't mean that they get to just decide that, you know, everything stops.
So this receiver has been appointed. I guess he takes over operation of the company.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally he steps in and will just, you know, make sure that they are, yeah, that they keep in, you know, in compliance. He'll work with the state, he'll work with the federal government. He'll kind of lead the company while they're like in a holding pattern trying to figure things out.
So the company, I think they did go through a bankruptcy. They haven't been producing for a while. What's the future of the company?
You know, we don't have that information yet, and that's something that we're definitely looking into along with the ecological impacts, because there's a the study about the human effects came out a while ago, I want to say like 2 years ago, but just in October they recently came out with you know what it's doing to birds, to microorganisms, to other wildlife in the area. So we're looking into a lot of stuff as, you know, follow-ups to this story.
U.S. Magnesium has been, suspected as a causer of air pollution as well. Is that what do we know about that?
I think they were still out of compliance with that. But a lot of that is that's the chlorine coming out of the magnesium production and turning into a gas. So since they are no longer generating that, you know, that process isn't like being sped up anymore.
Now, at least in the past, there it was suspected that, I don't know, chlorine or other chemicals was getting into groundwater, and then through groundwater into the suspected go into the lake. But what's happening at this point? I guess at this point, we don't think contamination is going to the lake.
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying earlier, that's, you know, the head of the Division of Water Quality said, you know, these chemicals are really sticky. They're going to hang into the soil as long as US Magnesium is not adding more water to the ponds. And adding things that would push things through to the groundwater and then maybe toward the lake. But since they aren't doing that right now, it's the chances are really low that the chemicals will keep like moving toward the lake.
By the way, just parenthetically, I was interested to remember from your reporting, I can't remember which state division this is, state forestry and lands and fire or something. They're responsible for, I guess, the lake bed, the banks, and the any minerals, I guess. And then the water division takes care of the water.
So we confirmed in the first story with Forestry, Fire, and State Lands that they hadn't been getting any royalties for the minerals because, right, they're in charge of kind of like that, like the outside and anything like the, like minerals coming out of the lake, like mineral extraction. They hold those contracts.
Megan, anything else you want to say about the story?
No, just that, keep expecting to hear about it because I think there's a lot more for us to dig into about, kind of the future of magnesium production and making sure that we protect the lake.
All right. Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta has been telling us about this story. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks, Tom.
We're going to head toward a break. When we come back, here's the headline: A new road will bring a new era for a multi-billion-dollar future at a former prison site at Boyne the Mountain. We'll be talking with real estate reporter Tony Semerad. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Tom.
So we want to talk about the development plans for where the state prison used to be, right?
Yeah, that's right. This is Utah's real estate slow play. It's been turning for more than 10 years as the state gradually moves towards demolishing the old prison, building a new prison facility up by Salt Lake City and moving everything up there. And now this land is not only open for development, but it's got significant infrastructure that the state has paid for. And on Tuesday, I believe it was, they started construction of a pretty key road that will serve that 100-acre site where the prison used to be.
So the new prison was constructed and opened operations, what, a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, about 2 years ago, they moved the 3,000 or so inmates up there and started tearing down the 70 or so year old prison down in Draper, which everybody sees driving on Interstate 15. Between Salt Lake County and Utah County. It's about the we're the fastest growing state as per the 2020 census, and this is about the fastest growing area in Utah, right there in that sort of south part of Salt Lake County, between Salt Lake County and Utah County. So the state has very ambitious development plans for that site, and those are sort of underway now with this road.
It was interesting how they did the groundbreaking. They didn't have leaders with golden shovels. How'd they do this one?
Yeah, when we arrived, there were six immense excavators arranged as though they would have been, had they been the typical golden shovel that you see at a groundbreaking, and the state's big wigs got in the cabin and dug up dirt together to kind of herald this new era represented by what's being called the point. And if it's any indication, this was a gala event in terms of the state's halls of power. We had the governor there, the Senate president, House speaker, a number of prominent department heads, state legislators, city, county officials. This is at the intersection of a number of different sort of government jurisdictions. And it's really become the point has really become sort of part of the way this state government kind of sees the state developing. This is being held up as sort of a model mixed-use development under the state's control.
So tell me a bit about the vision here. Mixed use, you say, so people be living there, there'll be shops, there'll be retail, but what's going to be there?
Well, for one thing, it's somewhat more kind of dense, I think, than a lot of typical suburban developments. And yes, indeed, there will be thousands of new housing units, offices and shops, a number of high-rise buildings going up in all of this, a lot of retail options. And it's really sort of a sort of live, work, play kind of vision that residents would be able to sort of enjoy a little sort of 15-minute city right there. A portion of the housing is supposed to be more moderately priced. There is some attention to affordable housing and all of this. And I think kind of more central to the vision, this involves a pretty major sort of ecological refresh for that area along the Jordan River. There's a sort of river to range system of parks and trails that are envisioned as part of this. It will be infused with green space, and is it's really sort of, as I say, being held up in a way as a kind of a model of mixed use development in the state and as well nationally. And as you may recall, a tremendous amount of public input went into what will happen on these this initial phase is 100 acres. Eventually, there could be as much as 600 acres there. It's quite a choice piece of property, but there have been many years of planning and public input that have gone into what happens at the point, and now that vision is at least on its way to becoming partly a reality.
Go to sltrib.com to see artist rendering of what this might look like. Will this be part of Draper or a separate city, or what's going to happen there?
Oh, it is most definitely part of Draper. There's a very interesting sort of component in this in the contracts and the plans that keeps this squarely in Draper's jurisdiction, even though it is a state site. And of course, longtime mayor, Draper Mayor Troy Walker has been instrumental, has been a member of the Point of the Mountain State Land Authority, and has sort of helped guide this. So it's very much in Draper's backyard, as it were.
How many people are going to live there, do they think?
Roughly the size of Bluffdale, nearby Bluffdale today, about 19,000 or so is the estimate. And it's going to the state's vision, it's important to note that Utah sees this as its innovation community rising. This is supposed to be a there's supposed to be a significant sort of hub in the at the center of the point that will be devoted to innovation in technology and finance and biomedical devices and that sort of thing. As though to create a kind of economic engine for the state. And this would be sort of there'd be an intersection with the state's universities and colleges where similar to kind of Research Park up at the University of Utah, where ideas generated by the state's academics and entrepreneurs would sort of be incubated, and that'll be sort of the great economic engine purportedly at the center of the point. But yeah, in answer to your question, about the size of at full build out, about the size of Bluffdale now, about 19,000 people, so.
That innovation part of this seems to have gotten state leaders pretty excited. They're speaking in hyperbole, in a kind of extreme excited terms about this. I guess we don't, it's nature of innovation. We don't know exactly what's going to come out of there, but they're hoping some big things.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see some of that innovation kind of rhetoric, if you want to call it that, take hold at the higher levels of the Governor's Office of Economic Opportunity, for example. The Salt Lake Chamber talks a lot about innovation, and there's sort of this feeling that that's in some ways Utah's niche, given our kind of entrepreneurial culture in the private sector. The state sort of wants to kind of harness some of that, and particularly, judging from, as you say, some of the vaunted talk that went on at the groundbreaking on Tuesday, that there seems to be a focus on these sort of cutting edge technologies like artificial intelligence and biotechnology, kind of exploiting some of the state's existing strengths in those industries.
I was interested to learn they tore down everything from the old prison, but they left the prison chapel. That's going to be preserved, I guess.
Yeah, there was a lot of to and fro as to what might be saved with the prison building. It's a huge, huge site. It was talk about keeping maybe one of the iconic guard towers and that sort of thing. And there was a lot of to and fro, and there was testimony on how much that particular building had meant to the inmates. Over the years, it was originally built by the inmates, a very interesting story going back to late 1950s, early 60s. And so yeah, it's actually a pretty stark sort of thing to see. This entire massive prison site has been sort of raised and flattened, and it's all clear except for this one little chapel that's sitting there. And yes, indeed, it's called Chapel by the Wayside, and it will be kept in all of this, and will sort of be like a little sort of historic presence ultimately when the point gets built.
So this road that's the starting point, the expansion of this road is Porter Rockwell Boulevard. There's a hat tip to some history.
Yeah, that's right. If I'm not mistaken, I think there was sort of a vestigial historic site, a remnant of Orrin Porter Rockwell there. He's a very colorful figure from pioneer eras, was bodyguard to Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, and something of a gunslinger, kind of one of those interesting characters in Utah's history. And so yeah, this will be a segment of road that will not only kind of intersect into the site, but it'll kind of create a little transportation loop around the primary area that they're going to be building, and this consortium of developers that the state hired about a year ago. This is essentially the kind of green light to vertical construction at the point of the mountain there. And as I say, as commuters go up and down I-15, they're going to start to see things going vertical on that site.
Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to Behind the Headlines, and we're talking right now with real estate reporter Tony Semmerad from the Salt Lake Tribune. Tony, have a few minutes here. I'd like to talk about another story you had out this week. This is looking at the future for Smith's Ballpark. So the Bees, the baseball team plays there, but I guess they won't next year. The owners are moving that out to a new place in Daybreak. So there's been a lot of community input here. I guess first of all, for those outside of Salt Lake City, where is this neighborhood?
This is about like about 77 West and 13 South. This is squarely in what's called the Ballpark neighborhood, its namesake. And yeah, the Salt Lake Bees, as we know, are headed out to South Jordan at Daybreak. And so the city has hired consultants and has a very robust public input process to sort of decide what will happen at that crucial site in the heart of the ballpark neighborhood. They've been looking at sort of three options have kind of emerged, if you will: save the whole thing, come up with some sort of a analogous kind of sports use for that site. They could save part of the stadium. It's very interesting. The structure of it lends itself to maybe preserving a part of those baseball stands, and then kind of building a mixed use kind of complex to lift the ballpark neighborhood kind of around that. And then the third option is to sort of tear it all down, and in that case, the main tenant, if you will, would be nature. And there'd be a significant sort of ecological remake of that spot, and tying in with other sort of green corridors. The Consultants for the city have been looking and engaging public input on this for almost a year now. It looks like the option of saving a section of the stadium, tearing down the rest, and then sort of building a mixed use kind of community hub, if you will, at that location. That's kind of emerging as the main idea or main option being drawing community support right now. And they've got a little ways to go in terms of refining that scenario, and it'll be going back out to the public, and looks like they're planning to be ready to put out some requests for proposals and that sort of thing on the site in the coming year.
What are the main concerns or the issues being brought up by residents? It's kind of an interesting opportunity. You get input from people. What's on their mind?
Yeah, this has been a kind of a unique analysis, and then it's very closely dovetailed with an analysis of health metrics in that particular neighborhood. Unfortunately, there are some of those metrics. Residents in that area struggle with certain issues that are challenging to health outcomes, and so the city's consultants have really sort of proceeded or sort of built their analysis on what will help Ballpark residents the most over time. So there's been, good deal of concern, of course, about economic giving that area an economic lift, providing community resources that will sort of help that. They're talking about mid-rise housing there that would be affordable, and that's included in all three of the options that they're looking at, that sort of approach to housing. Each of the scenarios is a little bit different in terms of what kind of health disparities they sort of seek to address, but that's sort of the city's overall approach is kind of trying to, whatever they do with the Smith's Ballpark site, trying to make that something that kind of optimizes the overall well-being of residents in that area.
One thing that stood out to me here is the possibility of turning at least part of West Temple in that area into a festival street, which I had to look up what a festival
Right,
street is.
that's that'd be that that'd be that little segment between 13th South and 14th South. That's the Salt Lake City's redevelopment agency has a broader kind of vision for the Ballpark neighborhood in terms of how it might develop and how the city could sort of help foster some of that. And that Festival Street's included in that RDA plan as well. There's been some calls for additional pedestrian and vehicle safety along 13th South. I'm sure some residents can kind of visualize that area. A lot of people kind of coming in and not especially pedestrian friendly in some areas around the Ballpark Stadium. They're hoping this can kind of address this. And again, there's not only talk of housing, but maybe some sort of kind of community aquatic center. Of various kind of sports applications that have been explored. It's also very interesting that Red Butte, Emigration, and Parley's Creek all kind of intersect there on their way to the Jordan River, and a couple of the options involve some sort of a kind of a natural recognition of that confluence of all the creeks and making it a much more sort of ecologically friendly kind of area.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks for telling us about these two very interesting projects. Tony Simmerat, real estate reporter for Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks.
You bet.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Mark Eddington. He'll tell us about this interesting Star Wars-themed resort deep in the Utah desert. We'll have that following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we turn next to reporter Mark Eddington. Mark, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So this is a fascinating story. Utah's got some really interesting stuff just kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Here's a new thing out there. It's called Outpost X. So I guess, first of all, Mark, where is this?
Well, it's believe it or not, it's not at the end of the world, although, you know, rumor has it you can see it from there. But it's about 50 miles west of Cedar City out in the West Desert. It's maybe a little east of Enterprise, and there's a Barrel Junction there. And you kind of head up Barrel Junction north for about 10 miles, and then a kind of an X marks the spot where you turn onto a dirt road and go another 4 or 5 miles until you see another X, and then you kind of pull in. And it's the resort situated on essentially what is a semi-dry lake bed that floods every now and again, but it's on 240 acres out in the middle of nowhere.
So this is interesting. The developer worked for the movie industry, right? What is his vision for this?
Yeah, Tom Chambers. You know, he graduated, I think, in public relations from Utah State. He owned his own ad agency and eventually sold that for $17 million. But yes, he was for a while. He worked as a social media manager for 20th Century Fox. And I have, think also he was involved to some extent with building these movie sets. But his vision essentially for the resort is he sees the movie industry, Hollywood, is kind of dying a little bit, especially when it comes to making epic movies. So he kind of wants to take these the movies from the reel, you know, the R-E-E-L to the reel, and kind of help people take their movies they might cherish and give them an experience or be able to immerse themselves in this. These kind of cinematic worlds in real life. And I think that's kind of what his vision is for the resort, for people to get that experience, immersive experience, and also maybe to get more get away from their devices somewhat and get more in touch with themselves, decompress, and maybe get a little closer to nature. So it kind of has a dual purpose, I think.
So this has been described as kind of Star Wars or Mad Max or Dune. You're out in this desert, right? So it's somewhat expensive, right? You have to pay what, $400 or $500 to do this per night. What?
So if you yeah, it,
yeah, go ahead.
Not cheap. I mean, it's not unreasonably expensive or anything, but yeah, I guess solitude and an immersive experience in the movies doesn't come cheap, but it ranges up to about $475 a night. You can rent the entire resort for $5,000, and they have like about 4 caves that are reminiscent, I think, of the caves Luke Skywalker lived in during the grew up in that first Star Wars movie, and they have, you know, all the modern amenities in there, so it's not like you're just roughing it or anything. And then they have some cheaper kind of glass geodesic sky domes. They call them Zen domes, 3 of those. So it's not a real large undertaking, if you will, in terms of size or scope. Although, well, the acreage is pretty large, but I mean, in terms of the actual structures, but it is certainly kind of gives a unique feel, I think. It's not like a typical 5-star hotel. For most luxury hotels, they have staff scrambling everywhere. But in Outpost X, I think they try to operate kind of on a skeleton staff. They have some caretakers. They have somebody that kind of hides out in this crevice in this, you know, man-made kind of cliff or rock. A manager to help out, and they kind of keep staffing at a minimum because they don't want to, they want a certain ambiance, if you will, and they don't want to do anything that would interfere with, you know, people's immersive experience into this world and with trying to get away from society, if you will, the pell-mell rush of everyday life in the city. So
understand they've created a whole universe, whole backstory right, that you can immerse yourself in. I guess you can pick a character and play that. It's designed to be immersive if you want to.
Yes, they have a. I'm not sure I pronounce it right, but Nemagin or something, and it's supposed to be a world that was, I think, depopulated to some kind of cosmic upheaval. And as a visitor, your task, should you choose to accept it and want to play along, is to you're there to rebuild that world, to repopulate it, to bring it back to its former glory. And to that end, when people book rooms there, they receive an email with a podcast that basically fills them in on the backstory of that world, and then talks about the different characters. And yes, when you're there, you can role play. They have about 20 for an extra fee. You can rent costumes. I think it's $20. You can rent costumes for one about 20 figures that play key roles in that fictional world. You could be an Echo Priestess, you could be a mercenary, one of the founders, just all sorts of things. So really, kind of the imagination is the limit, and how far people want to take it. Some people want to really get into that, and others perhaps just are there for the solitude, for the quiet. So, which, by the way, the solitude there, well, at least when we were there, could be deafening. I mean, it was just, it was different, but I liked it.
I guess one of the goals from Mr. Chambers was he wanted people to be able to experience nothingness, right?
Yeah, a little bit like Seinfeld,
Like Seinfeld, yeah.
Yeah, the show about nothing. It has that. That's about the only thing it has it's like that. But yes, they want people to reconnect, with themselves, and to be able to maybe relearn how to play, and just to decompress and get away from, the hustle bustle of life. In the city suburbs, all of us are so busy, and it for really. A major selling point of it is for people to get away, to relearn, to use their imagination, to indulge their imagination, and to reconnect with them, with themselves, and relearn perhaps how to play, like they did when they were kids. When we were kids, we all, many of us, used our imagination, and it seems like when you grow older and become an adult, you lose a little bit of that. So I think this is a way maybe to reconnect with your childhood in some ways.
I'm looking at a photograph here in the story of a land speeder. This is what something that designed to look like one Luke Skywalker would have used.
Yeah, they're modified golf course carts, and I think you charge them up, and the charge lasts for about a half an hour to 45 minutes or something. But you can tool around in these modified golf courts and the carts, and they're all individual. They call them sand cruisers, but they look just like land speeders from Star Wars. And they can go around to 20 different stations, which are placards, and they can read up on the history of Namajin and the resort. So it's a way, they look pretty cool. It's a way to motor around the playa, and to explore the resort a bit.
Looking at another photograph of a stairway to heaven. It's a staircase to nothing. It's just out in the playa.
Yeah, reminds me of that bridge to nowhere
Yeah.
Congress supposedly trying to build in Alaska years ago. But yeah, it's Chambers had a brother, I think, who died during construction of the resort a few years ago. I can't remember. I think he was in South America when he died, but it's a tribute to his brother, and so he built that as a in commemoration of his brother. But it's something that essentially it's just a stairway you climb up. There's a little perch. Some people go in there and meditate or stargaze. Some fly drones or take pictures. So it's kind of a esoteric kind of concept, but yeah.
Well, this idea, I guess it could have gone many different ways, but it seems like it's been a hit. They've been pretty continuously booked.
Yeah, I think they have a chamber said they have about a 90% occupancy rate. He was able to buy that land for about $110,000, if memory serves me correctly. And then I guess some, financial people were a little reluctant to do it, wondering about whether it was financially viable or feasible. And but he kind of, got a lot of his own friends in the construction business, and they kind of built themselves. He crowdsourced and raised another $900,000 or something like that, about that amount, which in exchange, for people having stays at the resort. And he said, like I say, it's been a hit, and they have people from all over the world that are staying there, coming, and including Star Wars fans group, fan groups, and movie buffs. They've had celebrities come there. I guess Kristen Chenoweth, the Tony Award-winning Broadway singer and actress, has been there. They've had a mixed martial arts champion stay there. They even had Secret Mormon Housewives, the producers of that show, that Hulu hit, called, wanted to film an episode down there, but Chambers just felt like that didn't kind of fit in with the brand, so he balked at that. So anyway, it just attracts families. It attracts all sorts of people that maybe don't want a conventional hotel experience, but want something a bit more adventuresome. So anyway.
So I guess it's been successful. So Chambers is looking to expand. I think he's one idea is a Viking themed resort somewhere.
Yeah, he's looking in the Rocky Mountains. I think he has plans to build 10 of these resorts all over the world. And in fact, before he built, when he sold his ad business in Lehi, which valuation about $17 million, he and his wife and kids, I think, traveled for the better part of a year going to all these different adventure resorts off the beaten path. And so now I think, given the success of this one, he said it's shown to be a viable, profitable enterprise. He wants to replicate that and do different resorts all over the country and or all over the world. And one of them is in Puerto Rico. He wants to do kind of a Swiss Family Robinson kind of jungle themed resort. And then he's trying to find a place in the Rocky Mountains, someplace with some water features or attractions or falls, where he could do a Viking style resort.
So this Utah obviously has become a kind of a destination for adventure, for for solitude, for this kind of thing. I was reading a story from earlier this year. Mark, a developer, set up a, I guess, a resort or a place for stargazers near Bryce Canyon. That's another example.
Yeah, it's near Cannonville. I can't remember the place, but they have sky domes there, and yeah, they're it's true. A lot of people are not real jazzed about it. They feel like, they're overbuilding and kind of destroying the very solitude that they're supposedly offering people. But yeah, it's Southern Utah has emerged as a hot spot for that. You have a lot of glamping sites like Under Canvas off of Kolob Terrace Road. Off of Highway 9, you have Auto Camp, I think, where they have Airstream trailers that people can rent, and just all sorts of properties cropping up all over the place. And I think this Outpost X is kind of a continuation of that trend, although it's quite a bit more remote and on a bit of a smaller scale.
Well, thanks for telling us about this, Mark Hennington. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week, and we'll start with Megan Banta. Megan, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Mine's the one from kind of yesterday. They got up and posted and then updated during the day, about the potential fate of the state's school voucher program from Peyton and from Carmen.
All right, check that out at sltrib.com. Tony Semmerad, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, I'm not sure if it's underplayed, but it's definitely breaking. One from our colleague Jordan Miller on Salt Lake County's plans to buy a former Overstock corporate headquarters in Midvale, and moved the Salt Lake County government complex from State Street in Salt Lake City out to Midvale. They announced that purchase and are gonna, I think, about 52 million. It's the old, it's sort of like a Coliseum-shaped building out in Midvale that Overstock used to have. Interesting story.
All right, check that out at sltrib.com. Mark Eddington, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Mine's a little bit unusual because I don't really cover sports, but I'm interested in the impact of this AJ DeBonsa, this the number one high school player in the country who's going to BYU. It's going to get about between $5 and $7 million in name, image, and likeness money. And Gordon Monson had a column about it, and just what that portends for BYU. And I think it's fascinating. BYU's traditionally not got those caliber of recruits. So, how will that transform that program? How is this kind of money, transform collegiate athletics in Utah in general? I think it'll be interesting to see where this goes and how it affects the sporting landscape here in the state of Utah.
Yeah, interesting story. That was a surprise to get a player of that caliber here in, in Utah and BYU, more specifically. You can check that out at sltrib.com as well. I'll throw in this one from Julie Jagg. Here's the first line. Members of the union representing the Park City Ski Patrol authorized a strike over the weekend, potentially putting Park City's mountains holiday operations in jeopardy. I didn't know ski patrollers were unionized. Apparently they are, and they're going on strike. Check that one out at sltrib.com as well. Well, we've been talking on this edition of Behind the Headlines with Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. We've been talking with real estate reporter Tony Simmerad. Thanks.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Have a good weekend.
You too. And reporter Mark Eddington has been with us. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you, and thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll give the reporters the Christmas week off. I'll be back in 2 weeks right here, and thanks, everyone, for listening.